This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to the show. I'm Lee Chwee Lin. The idea of no man or woman being left behind can be an important component of a civil society, but with all the considerations of cost and logistics, this sentiment doesn't always reflect in healthcare. Professor Peter Hotez, Dean of the National School of Tropical Medicine at Baylor College in Texas, discusses neglected tropical diseases. Professor Hotez is joining me over the phone. So firstly, what are neglected tropical diseases?
Well, we call them neglected tropical diseases. It's a bit of a misnomer. They really are diseases of profound poverty, diseases of the poorest people in the poorest countries. And we've recently completed an analysis of the Southeast Asian region. If you look at the 10 or so countries of the ASEAN region, where you have a population of 600 million people, as you know, it's been an incredibly fast-growing economy. In some cases with double-digit economic growth, and countries like Malaysia have been particularly successful. But this economic growth throughout the Southeast Asian region, we now realize, has left behind almost a third of its population, a fourth to a third of its population, who live on no money, who live on less than $2 a day. And there we're seeing widespread tropical infections affecting that bottom 200 million people.
So when would you define a disease as neglected? When would it fall into this category as opposed to just belonging to the category of tropical diseases or infectious diseases?
So that's a great question. We define them as these are chronic debilitating infections that disproportionately affect people living in extreme poverty. And they often go sight unseen. We say they're forgotten diseases among forgotten people. So I could give you some examples, if you'd like, of some of the specific neglected tropical diseases that are affecting the Southeast Asian region.
What are these? I mean, I was reading that dengue is amongst them, and of course that's a huge problem here in Malaysia.
Right. So dengue is one that kind of sits on the edge. That is both a neglected tropical disease. It does disproportionately affect people living in poverty, but it also affects a growing middle class and even wealthy people as well. So dengue is kind of one we don't know quite what to do with. The World Health Organization is not defining it as a neglected tropical disease, and it certainly has some features of it, but it's not as one as we classically would define it.
And what are some other examples of neglected tropical diseases that would affect us, particularly in this region?
Sure. So good examples are the intestinal worm infections. So one called ascariasis that affects basically half the people that live in extreme poverty in Asia. It's intestinal roundworm infection or hookworm infection that affects about a third of the people living in poverty. Or liver fluke infection, that's actually a cause of cancer. It's actually a worm cause of cancer that's disproportionately affecting the northern Thailand region and Laos and even parts of Cambodia, malaria, and then it's just the schistosomiasis and leprosy. These are all examples of diseases of the poorest people in the region.
How common are neglected tropical diseases? I mean, if they're affecting the poor in our region, then I would assume fairly common.
They're actually, basically every single person living in extreme poverty has one or more of these diseases, and their effects are quite interesting. Not only are they affecting health, but now we have data to support the fact that these diseases actually trap people in poverty. They make people too sick to go to work every day. They actually prevent children from growing and developing. We can show that it shaves intelligence points off of children. So that we have studies to show, for instance, that chronic hookworm infection in a child in Southeast Asia will reduce his or her future wage earning by 40%. Or that the economic growth of a country will lose billions of dollars because people are too sick to go to work because of lymphatic filariasis or schistosomiasis or malaria. So these are the stealth reasons why the poorest people cannot be lifted up to the same level as the other 400 million people who are being quite successful in Southeast Asia.
And when we look at these diseases, I mean, the cycle of poverty is always a very, very troubling one, and it can often exist intergenerationally. Is this something that we see with neglected tropical diseases as well? That's something that a parent contracts, for instance, their child may still get despite their efforts, obviously, to try and prevent that?
So you said it beautifully. It really is intergenerational poverty, so that the parents are infected, the children are infected, and then, of course, their children's children are destined to be infected unless there is some intervention that happens. And so this is one of the tragic features. These diseases both occur in the setting of poverty, and they support poverty as well. And so one of the things that we're working very hard with National School of Tropical Medicine, and now we've started a new initiative, University of Malaya, to actually break that cycle. And it's very exciting that we think our collaboration between the University of Malaya and the National School of Tropical Medicine here in Texas is actually going to, we have a means now to break that terrible, vicious cycle of poverty.
Altogether, there are six different categories of infections. What distinguishes each category from the next?
Well, I'm not sure what you mean by the six different categories.
Well,
did you mean the different diseases? Or?
Yeah, the different diseases, because when you look it up on the WHO page, for example, they kind of separate the diseases into different categories, different modes of infection.
Well, the neglected tropical diseases have these common sets of features, and they go something along the following lines. They tend to be chronic and debilitating infections. They tend to be actually poverty-promoting. And another interesting feature is they're kind of the opposite of what we sometimes think of as emerging infections, like SARS, for instance, which seem to appear out of nowhere. These neglected tropical diseases have been around forever, so they're ancient conditions. You can find descriptions of these diseases in ancient texts. And so you talk about intergenerational poverty. These have been around forever. And so now what we're doing is seeing what we can do about them. And we've taken on two approaches. One, we can do a lot with some medicines that we have in hand today. Many of them are being donated by the major pharmaceutical companies. And by this mass drug administration approach, we actually are having a big impact on reducing poverty in the region. But there's certain diseases for which we need new interventions for, and that's why we're trying to work now with the University of Malaya to develop a whole new generation of control tools. By control tools, I mean new drugs, new vaccines, new diagnostics for conditions.
Yeah, that's something that I want to get into a little more. But before that, there's this idea. Poverty exists in a lot of different forms in many, many countries around the world. When looking at creating interventions for neglected tropical diseases, how do you need to factor in the regional and national differences?
Well, we can take, for instance, let's take the country of Malaysia, for instance, where we have a country of about 30 million people, but you have about 2% of the population living on no money, living on less than $2 a day. So you're talking about, in Malaysia, the case of about 700,000 people that live in extreme poverty. And mind you, this is not unique to Malaysia. We have in the United States, for instance, we have 1.65 million families living on less than $2 a day. So it's a consistent theme over just about every country on the planet that economic growth always leaves behind a bottom subset. It's a matter of how large that subset is. So in Malaysia, it's relatively small, but it's still significant like it is in the United States. So and many of these are indigenous peoples as well. The Orang Asli, for instance, are disproportionately living in some areas of poverty. And so we now have to develop new interventions for these conditions. And there it's quite interesting because the major pharmaceutical companies are not taking on these diseases. And for a very obvious reason, there's not going to be much of a financial return. The financial return is lifting people out of poverty. So what we've realized now with the University of Malaya is that we're going to have to develop these new tools, these new vaccines, diagnostics, drugs in the nonprofit sector. And that's exactly what we're trying to do right now.
So what are some specific interventions that can be made, or rather have been made, that you've been a part of to break the cycle of neglected tropical diseases?
So one of them is a new vaccine for hookworm infection, which affects about 77 million people among the ASEAN countries, including Malaysia, but it's also especially widespread in countries such as Indonesia or the Philippines. And this is a vaccine that's now entering, that has been in clinical trials for a couple of years now, and we're hoping to advance that. And that would be a great vaccine to develop jointly with the University of Malaya, for instance. And we think there's a lot of sophistication in Malaysia and a great opportunity. Another example is a vaccine for schistosomiasis, which is a particularly big problem in Indonesia as well as the Philippines. There again, we're about to go into clinical trials and we're looking at a joint collaboration. The dengue vaccine is about the only one that is being developed by the big pharmaceutical companies because they do see a reasonable rate of return on that. So the four or five major pharmaceutical companies are working on a dengue fever vaccine. But so we're kind of taking on the rest, and we're hoping to do that with the university.
When it comes to tropical diseases, is their prevalence an issue of a lack of awareness or more a lack of available treatment or perhaps a little bit of both?
It's a combination. There are multiple factors that contribute to the neglect. I think people living in extreme poverty often go sight unseen, so we don't take the time to understand their diseases. So I'm certain that the average person in Malaysia, just like the average person in the United States, knows more about Ebola, for instance, than it does about the neglected tropical diseases affecting their own populations. So, that's quite interesting. What gets to the attention of the media is often not reflective of what the diseases that are actually widespread in the region.
I'm speaking today to Professor Peter Hotez, Dean of the National School of Tropical Medicine at Baylor College in Texas. We are discussing neglected tropical diseases. Coming up, we learn a little bit more about the current research and efforts that have been made to combat NTDs, as well as what the 1090 gap is on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. You are listening to The Bigger Picture. I'm Lee Chui Lin. With me over the phone today, Professor Peter Hotez, Dean of the National School of Tropical Medicine at Baylor College in Texas. We are discussing neglected tropical diseases, something that's very pertinent to us here in Malaysia, but that perhaps we don't often think enough about. Professor Hotez, how would you describe the current research and efforts to combat neglected tropical diseases? Has it, is it sufficiently prominent?
Well, one of the big problems that we have is these are the diseases of the world's poorest people. And so as a result, we're not seeing a big investment by the major pharmaceutical companies into taking on these diseases. And what we have found is that the pharmaceutical companies have been good about donating existing drugs. It's not that they're uncaring. It's just that it's very hard for a for-profit multinational company to convince their shareholders to invest tens of millions of dollars into products that will not bring financial return. So we've decided to take matters in our own hand, and that is with the National School of Tropical Medicine, together with the Sabin Vaccine Institute. It is a unique type of organization known as a PDP, a product development partnership. These are nonprofit organizations that use industry practices to make stuff. And by stuff, I mean either new diagnostics, new vaccines, new small molecule drugs. And we're trying to take the lead role in developing neglected tropical disease vaccines. And something very exciting that we've started this year is we are now entering a joint partnership with the University of Malaya to develop these products jointly for the Southeast Asian region.
In your paper, you've mentioned that research and development into NTDs has not reached the 1090 gap. Firstly, what is this gap?
So the 1090 gap was a term coined in the year 2000 by the Global Health Forum and Research, and it was based on an analysis that showed that only about 10% of the world's financial resources go into supporting diseases that affect 90% of the world's population, that is, the population living in great poverty. So that we have great investments for diseases such as diabetes or heart disease or cancer, but tenfold less in diseases such as intestinal worms and lymphatic filariasis and malaria and leprosy and even dengue fever. So our Product Development Partnership, our PDP, was created to address that. And the way we're trying to do this is not do it by ourselves, but do it jointly with governments or universities in the disease-infected countries or regions. And because the Southeast Asian region, we now know, is a hot spot of neglected tropical diseases, you know, so often we think of these kinds of diseases, diseases of sub-Saharan Africa. But again, in the Asian countries of Southeast Asia, you have 200 million people who live on no money, and with it, widespread diseases there, we're trying to take these on.
I understand that there is obviously a need to work with policymakers, with NGOs, with universities to cover that ground, I suppose, that pharmaceutical companies perhaps cannot or will not because of the cost. But what is the efficacy of trying to, I guess, wrangle collaboration between all these disparate stakeholders, and does it result in quick intervention?
Well, I think what we're going to have to require looking forward is a consortium of different types of organizations. So I do think the multinational pharmaceutical companies do have a role, but unlike traditional approaches for diseases such as heart disease or cancer, it's unrealistic to think that they're going to take the leadership on this. So I think what we're looking at is maybe perhaps leadership with indigenous institutions in places like Malaysia, which has a lot of sophistication in science, working jointly with product development partnerships like ours, the National School of Tropical Medicine, together with a handful of developing countries. And I think these kinds of new types of partnerships are going to be needed. The exciting thing, the scary thing is also the exciting thing, in that there's no roadmap here. There's no roadmap for how we're going to make products for diseases that affect the poorest people. So we're learning as we go along. So one thing's clear, we cannot rely exclusively on the multinational pharmaceutical companies, nor I think can we rely exclusively on nonprofit organizations. We're going to need unprecedented levels of partnerships to make these products happen. So often what I like to say is our technology, our ability to actually make vaccines for neglected tropical diseases, in some sense, has outpaced our social and political institutions that we have in order to ensure these products get developed and are made accessible to the people who need them in poorest countries. So this has to be fixed. So there's also a not only great need for innovation at the technical level for these products, but also at the policy level, also at the social science level. So one of the things that we're working with social scientists, we're working with the economists, we're working with the sociologists, because they're telling us a lot of important information on what we need to ensure these products reach the people who need them the most.
Millions of individuals receive donated or low-cost generic drugs, which can lead to the elimination of certain infections or at least better management of it. Why can't this be done across the board for tropical diseases?
So you're absolutely right. There are certain, we do have certain medicines available in hand right now that could eliminate some diseases in Southeast Asia. So for instance, there's one called lymphatic filariasis, which is also known as elephantiasis, which is widespread in countries such as Indonesia, but it's also very common in the Philippines and in Myanmar. And there, we've been able to show through mass treatment over a period of 4 or 5 years, you could actually eliminate these diseases as a public health problem. And the Japanese company Eisai is actually donating the medicine needed for it free of charge. So it's actually a free intervention. So it's just the cost of administering the medicine once a year. So in that case, it's a really relatively straightforward solution. On others, though, the diseases, even if you treat them, keep coming back for diseases such as hookworm or liver fluke infection. And so the mass treatment approach is a stopgap measure, but it's not going to be adequate by itself to eliminate these diseases. And that's why we're going to need a new generation of vaccines that will probably be developed jointly with organizations such as ours and with the University of Malaya.
Are there issues when it comes to the distribution of the drugs? Because I would assume that there would be some logistical issues, especially when you're looking at distributing drugs to large amounts of people in underdeveloped areas.
Yeah, you're right, because although they can be found in the big cities, more often than not, they're found in remote rural areas, of areas of extreme poverty that are inaccessible with good roads. And so this does present logistical hurdles. So the two things that we've realized we have to do is, one, whenever possible, it should be an intervention that could be given in a single dose, maybe once a year if possible. And then the product itself has to be extremely inexpensive, whether it's a donated drug or even our vaccines that we're developing. We've been working with a group of economists that tell us that they said to me, look, if you can't make this vaccine for less than $1, $2, or $3 a dose, you might as well not make it at all because it'll never be used. So one of the things that we do in our vaccine development organization is that we build in low-cost processes right from the very beginning. So we identify mechanisms to maximize the yield, maximize the purity at the lowest possible cost, so we could make a $2 vaccine or a $3 vaccine. So it's quite a different mindset, for instance, from a major pharmaceutical company that's making something like the papillomavirus vaccine against cervical cancer. That's a vaccine that costs more than $100 a dose. Well, it's a great product, but it'll never be used by the world's poorest people. So it's one of the things that we try to avoid is using expensive processes in how we make a vaccine.
There are vaccines that aren't batting at 100% efficacy. I mean, there are some that look between 60 to 70%, for example. At what point does it become worthwhile to distribute a vaccine to these populations? Or is it so long as there is one, we should just push it out?
So that's a very insightful question. And this is something that the entire field of neglected disease vaccines is struggling with right now. And I'll give you an example. So the new malaria vaccine that was developed jointly by GlaxoSmithKline with generous support from the Gates Foundation, it's causing significant reductions in malaria deaths, but we're looking at between 30 and 50% efficacy. So the question is, would that vaccine be used? You know, we're so used to hearing about vaccines that are 90% efficacious for diseases such as polio and measles that we've gotten a bit, I wouldn't say spoiled, but we've gotten elevated expectations about what a vaccine can do. And so I think this new generation of vaccines, because they're more complicated, the disease targets are harder, may not perform at that same level of efficiency. And so we're trying to now establish a policy for what you do for what we call partially protective vaccines. And so, for instance, a malaria vaccine may not replace existing measures such as bed nets or antimalarial drugs, but it would be used as a companion alongside antimalarial drugs and bed nets. And I think that still doesn't negate the importance of the vaccine. It's just that we may have to start thinking about how to use them in different ways.
So when it comes to neglected tropical diseases right now, is the long-term goal ultimately disease elimination, or, you know, are there other aspects of disease control that you're looking into first?
Well, elimination is certainly the gold standard, because if you can interrupt, reduce the amount, the prevalence, or the number of people who are infected below the point where you can interrupt transmission, that may provide a mechanism to not have to continually revaccinate every year. Having said that, elimination is still a very high bar. I mean, we're still talking about the elimination of polio worldwide, even though we've had a very good vaccine developed by Dr. Albert Sabin more than 50 years ago. So I think the aspirational goal is elimination, or maybe even in some cases eradication. But more realistically, I think we should be very focused on control approaches.
What exactly would elimination or eradication take? I mean, what kind of measures in an ideal world would need to happen?
So it really is very specific to the disease that you're trying to address. So for instance, malaria elimination is very complicated, because, or intestinal worm elimination, because remember, in the case of intestinal worms, the infective stages are practically ubiquitous in the soil. or they're on inert substances. So, for instance, in the Philippines, there was a study a number of years back to show you could actually scrape the eggs of Ascaris lumbricoides, the cause of intestinal roundworm, off the paper currency in the Philippines. And so this is how widespread they are. So it is a very complicated endeavor to actually interrupt transmission of these diseases. But even if you can't totally interrupt transmission and effect elimination, you can still do a lot of good by controlling the disease and reducing the bioburden of these diseases among the poorest people in the country. And it actually has the very striking effect of lifting them out of poverty.
NTDs, you know, the word poverty has come up a lot in our conversation. And however, they can also occur in developed countries, in middle-class communities. What consequences might this misconception have? Or is the population of infection among developed countries so small that it's manageable?
Well, it can occur among the middle-class in countries, but An example is dengue fever, which clearly can occur among the middle class. But most of these diseases we're seeing among the poor living among the wealthy. And this is a new concept that we've been looking at. It's one we call blue marble health, and it's to give it a new name to global health. You know, the old idea of global health is talking about wealthy countries versus developing countries, you know, a country such as Malaysia versus a country such as Laos. And that kind of idea is a bit antiquated, because what we're finding is most of the world's nations are rising in their economy. And so nations are becoming wealthier as economic development continues. But what it does is it leaves behind a bottom segment of society that remains mired in poverty. And it happens in just about every country. So in the United States, you have country of 300 million, you have 20 million living in extreme poverty. Or Malaysia, where you have a country of 30 million that's leaving behind 700,000 in extreme poverty. Or in Mexico, where you have a country of 100 million, about 10 million in extreme poverty. And this is where we're finding the neglected tropical diseases. So it's not, this concept of developing versus developed is becoming somewhat outdated as we progress in time, in favor of what we're finding is pockets of extreme poverty among the wealthy. And it's a concept to give it a new name. Other than global health, we're calling it blue marble health, in commemoration of when the Apollo 17 astronauts took a picture of the Earth from the moon in 1972 and said the Earth looks like just like a big blue marble. And I think this is very important, because what it means is that we're finding about 60 to 70% of the world's neglected tropical disease, paradoxically, are occurring in the G20 countries, the 20 wealthiest economies. But they're occurring in focal areas such as Western China, Northern India, the Southern United States, Southern Mexico, Northern Argentina, Northeastern Brazil, and even in pockets of Malaysia. It means that all of the nations of the world have a responsibility to target their own indigenous neglected tropical diseases, and that alone will have a big impact on reducing the global burden of these conditions.
In a paper, you've mentioned that one key component is the involvement of the World Health Organization. Why is their involvement critical?
Because they're a neutral broker, and they have tremendous convening power. So the World Health Organization's Director General, Margaret Chan, what she does is every year convenes all of the world's health ministers in Geneva, Switzerland, at what's called the World Health Assembly. It's usually in May of each year, in order to adopt resolutions by which countries will agree upon to share resources in order to target diseases. And this is a very powerful role that the World Health Organization has, and one that's been very successful over the years, and particularly in neglected tropical diseases. I think the World Health Organization has done an excellent role. And in the case of the Asian region, there are regional offices of WHO through what's called CIRO or WIPRO, the Western Pacific Regional Organization. And again, these are very top-flight organizations that are very committed to disease control.
Taking a look at the social aspect for just a minute, In developing countries, age-old traditions of treatment may differ from current developing treatments, especially when it comes to diseases that they've been battling for a long time. How do you mitigate this possible conflict?
You mean the use of traditional medicines?
Yes, that's right.
Yeah, I think traditional medicines have a very interesting role, but it should not prevent the use of proven methods, also proven by scientific research, to have a big effect. So it tends not to be either or. I think we have to look at how we use medicines in collaboration with the culture of an individual population and to work within the belief system. And I think that could be easily done in most cases through health education and explaining how these medicines work and what their impact would be.
On the other hand, the current drug most commonly used in the battle against malaria, artemisinin, was derived from traditional Chinese herbs. Are researchers currently looking into traditional modes of treatment and seeing what can be derived or isolated and, used?
Yeah, I think the problem with administering only the plant itself gets into inconsistencies with the level of active ingredient in the plant that's having the pharmacological effect. So, for instance, one batch of plants could have a certain level of medicine, while another could have a much lower, much higher amount. And so I think a more effective approach is to extract the active ingredient from the plant, be able to measure the amount, and then to administer that into a pill form. And that's why artemisinin has become such a powerful medicine to be used worldwide, the ability to standardize it, and also to work in collaboration with national regulatory authorities. In the U.S., we have the FDA. Each Southeast Asian country has its own national regulatory authority to standardize it, ensure quality, and to exercise quality control over the medicine.
And sadly, when it comes to diseases like NTDs, sometimes the motivation to do enough about it isn't always present. How would eliminating diseases common in developing regions affect developed nations and the rest of the world?
Well, I think what we have to recognize is that these diseases are the stealth cause of poverty. And so by treating, in some cases eliminating, these neglected tropical diseases, we're actually having a direct effect on poverty reduction. And that's very powerful, because what it's doing is bringing the bottom segment of society with respect to economic development up to a much higher level. So it's one of the most efficient ways of bringing people closer to the level of the middle class is to take on these neglected tropical diseases. And that's not an easy message to get across, because in many cases, dengue can be a killer disease, but most of the neglected tropical diseases are actually more debilitating than they are killing. And often they present not in dramatic fashion like an Ebola infection, but through subtle insidious effects that last over years in an individual's lifetime. So recognizing that many of the poorest people are poor because they're suffering from an infectious disease is not often an intuitive concept for people, but that is in fact the case, and why we have to be so aggressive in intervening in getting people off poverty level.
And you mentioned you've mentioned the collaboration with University of Malaya. Can you tell us roughly, has that begun?
Yes, we've launched a very exciting collaboration with the Departments of Medical Microbiology and the Departments of Parasitology at the Faculty of Medicine of the University of Malaya, working with Dr. Sazali Abubakar and eventually others as well, as a joint initiative with the University of Malaya, perhaps National Institutes of Health. And one of the things that impressed me, this is my first visit to Malaysia, is the quality of the science is pretty high, and the sophistication of the science is quite high. So I think there's great potential for Malaysia to take on a leadership role in developing these neglected tropical disease products, and one that we're quite excited about working with them.
And finally, what message would you have for us on the subject of neglected tropical diseases, especially in our country?
I think this is a tremendous opportunity. As I mentioned at the start of the broadcast, we're looking at 200 million people in Southeast Asian countries, especially the large ones like Indonesia and the Philippines and Myanmar, who live in absolute poverty. And this is a great opportunity, I think, for Malaysia to provide leadership for the region. It's got all of the pieces in place to become a leader in biotechnology for neglected disease products. It's got sophistication in science. It's got some sophistication in biotechnology. It's got a forward-thinking government. It's got a an economic system in place that's robust. It's got all the pieces in place to take a leadership role in making neglected tropical disease vaccines and diagnostics and other products. And I think that's our role at the National School of Tropical Medicine, the Sabin Vaccine Institute, is to help serve as a catalyst for your outstanding universities and research institutes to have this important role. And I think, if this were to, looking 10 years down the line or even 5 years down the line, I think you're going to see a lot of excitement coming out of Kuala Lumpur and coming out of Malaysia.
Thank you very much, Professor Hotez. I've been speaking to Professor Peter Hotez, Dean of the National School of Tropical Medicine at Baylor College in Texas. We have been discussing neglected tropical diseases on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.